Welcome to Extraordinary People.
We're here to celebrate everyday people who are on a mission to change the world however they can. From working with survivors of domestic violence to building awareness of mental health issues, our guests each have their own unique approach to addressing challenges close to their hearts and making life a bit better. Today I'm talking to Rick Mower. Rick is the founder and CEO of Raw Workshop, an Oxfordshire-based social enterprise which produces and sells beautiful, high-quality wood products, provide a wood recycling service and sell reclaimed timber. Not only are they an environmentally sustainable business, 75% of their workforce have fought and won against the odds. Let's talk to Rick and hear more about Raw in his own words. Rick, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very good, thank you. How are you doing?
I am dandy, thank you. Absolutely dandy.
Dandy. So Raw sounds like an amazing enterprise. Could you explain for our listeners what you actually do?
We're basically, in effect, an enterprise, a business, and we manufacture furniture, indoor and outdoor furniture. We have a waste recycling business. We retail reclaim wood. We have a grounds maintenance business. We trade with and against the normal competition, but the difference with us is the majority of our workforce have come from backgrounds that might be different to yours and mine. So the vast majority of our workforce will have, you know, overcome life experiences including addiction, mental health, homelessness, trouble with the law, all that kind of stuff. And we employ those people because they actually are the best workforce you can have. And I think that's one of the things that Raw set out to do, was prove that, you know, people are not their past.
All sounds really good. Where did the idea actually come from?
So my background is kind of in advertising agencies and that kind of stuff in London years ago. And there were a couple of things happening. One was, you know, a lot of brands getting more into being sustainable and being seen as sustainable and that kind of stuff. And they weren't really doing it properly, I don't think. It was more about marketing. But the main thing for me was some of my own experience and people close to me that it just struck me that when somebody has been to prison or had a crap childhood or been excluded from school or been on the streets or overcome an addiction, when they've come through all that stuff, we as society kind of go, oh, now you're disadvantaged. It's just nonsense. They're disadvantaged by society standards of NVQs and qualifications, not in terms of resilience, not in terms of creativity, not in terms of the ability to survive. And once you capture that and reflect that back to somebody that actually they have got something really special in them that's not defined by someone else's criteria, and you set that free, you have an amazing, tenacious, creative, and massively loyal workforce. And I think the other thing that really made me a little upset, I suppose, was that a lot of people would kind of be apologetic about people. Like, oh, we're a charity and we work these people. It's been very difficult for them and they need support. And yeah, lots of times they do, but the relationship struck me as odd, because a lot of people who are frankly phenomenal, and it's usually their past or their childhood that's led them to the choices they've made or the situation they've been in, you know. And what I wanted to do was, we don't actually really overtly kind of trade on, we employ lots of people who have different backgrounds or we're really worthy. It's not that at all. We trade on great services and great products. Then people realize, oh my goodness, what, somebody who has been in prison can do that. Somebody who's been addicted can do that. Yeah, that's how we change people's minds, not by, you know, nice liberal middle class people like me sort of doing talks and podcasts going, oh, you know, everyone deserves a chance. It's actually about doing stuff, you know, and giving people a bloody platform to show how good they are. I think that's it, really.
So it's all about show, not tell.
Yeah, it's show and tell. And also it's putting a big broadside into these massive kind of warships of corporates who've run these cartels of, you know, we're all, you know, you can't compete with us. Yeah, we can, because we can do it at the same price. We can do it at the same speed. We can do it at the same technology. And we'll win contracts because we change lives, because we're better to the environment. That's how we'll win contracts. And the reason that we do that is for the reasons I've said, but also the more market share we can take off the big established players, the only thing they can do is change how they recruit people. The only thing they can do is behave better. They can't outcompete us on price and quality. They won't, because we've got a better workforce, frankly. So that's how we set about doing it, you know. And for, you know, for people to who've had, where they've been told they're rubbish or felt they're rubbish or done wrong things, you know, our crew can walk around various parks or buildings or offices of corporates and go, I did that. That was me. You know, or they can see our stuff online or they can see it in retailers and go, that was me. You know, and that's something that is more powerful than anything else.
That's real activism, doing something that directly impacts people, individuals, at the same time as influencing change within business so that corporates, like you said, are forced to review the situation or how they do business.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and that is the key thing, you know, because my background is commercial and brands and marketing and development and stuff. And, you know, and if you said to anybody short of a dictator, would you like to be nicer to people and be nicer to the environment? Yes, we would. And they probably will at some point. You know, they'll do it under pressure. You hit their bottom line, they will change really fast. And that's the reality of the world. That's the post-COVID world, right? Especially now. We've had more growth in the last few months than ever. Because the world is seeing we have to behave better. We have to make the right choices. We have to support people. We're kinder. I think we've had sort of a wave of kindness come over us. Combine that with the fact you can't get stuff out of the Far East anymore because it's so hard to ship it. Combine the fact that, you know, when a tanker gets stuck in the Suez Canal, everyone's supply chain goes down. Combine the fact with Brexit, we're in a sweet spot as social entrepreneurs to really go for it now. This is our time.
You think since the pandemic, the world's changed. Are people a lot more receptive to what you're doing? Are you finding it easier to reach customers and clients and to sell, basically?
Yeah, absolutely. There's absolutely no doubt. And that stacks up through our figures and the contracts. It was what's definitely changed is the conversation gone from, oh, yeah, we'd really like to do more of this. We'd really like to do it, to being, we must do this. How do we work you into it? There's been a definite shift on the corporate side. And I think people as well, generally people, there are a lot of people who sought out doing the right thing. And now it's becoming normalized, especially for younger people. Why would I buy from a company that doesn't do that? You know, we've moved, you know, and I think we were moving, but definitely the pandemic has brought it to sharper focus.
And from to look at your website, yeah, when you talk about a corporate contract, what are you producing for corporates?
Across all our businesses. So on the furniture side, we do a lot of office fit outs, office furniture, and we do hospitality trade. We do, you know, this is not little bits of, you know, garden furniture for. We do some private stuff. Well, for example, we're just contracting with Grosvenor Estates, which, you know, quite a large, you know, multi-billion pound company on a development in Oxford where we've consulted and also supplying all the outdoor scheme to really make the outdoor space more effective for the community, a nicer place to be, and join up two areas. So there's a new development and an old one where, you know, there's a bit of friction. And actually creating a space in between those, which is massive, but really works well together. And, you know, we're talking about big, big contracts. And likewise on grounds maintenance, you know, I think we've now got 120 properties under our management, outdoor areas, because corporate clients would rather buy a service that, you know, has some impact built into it and is a bit cleaner. And with the waste recycling, basically, our waste recycling produces less carbon than a skip does and a skip lorry does. So for us, the developing side is going bonkers. So yeah, it's a very, very corporate side of the business.
With 75% of your workforce having had to overcome overwhelming odds, is it challenging to start working together at the very beginning? You talked about how you need to tell them or how you change the narrative for them. You tell them that they are a survivor and they're resilient and it's what's... And their success in conquering whatever the odds are that they've had to overcome have made them who they are. So what are the main obstacles you think one of your employees might face when starting a new job at Raw?
They're exactly the same obstacles you and I face starting a new job. You're meeting new people. You're in a new environment. Who's who? It's quite frightening. It's no different to that. But imagine that multiplied by 10 times. Who's looking at me? Do they know about me? Am I good enough? So it's really quite emotional. So all we do, we just apply a bit of kindness and love and decency and patience. So people will start where they feel most comfortable. And the reason for that is, without being kind of, I suppose, best way, yeah, we're all primates, okay? So if you look at how a troop of the primates works. You know, if you go to, if they go to an area, they'll sit somewhere quite quietly first, and they'll just get the lay of the land. They'll smell the forest and stuff. And I'm not making a direct comparison, but there's something about being a human where you, your environment needs to be safe. So you spend some time where you feel safest. And that's why people tend to start with us in one area, and around 90% do not stay in that area of the business after the first couple of weeks. It's just that time to acclimatize, I guess. You know, it's not rocket science. And I think it's also this narrative around, well, you've had really your darkness and it's difficult, and you it's a site sort of threat. There's nothing. It's just somebody who's come from a slightly different background, you know, and they might need a different time to adapt. And it's our job. It's our job to make, as with any employee in any company, make them feel comfortable and valued and safe. That's the basic. You know, the pay and the training, that's all, you know, that's all, you know, stuff that comes. But actually, are you happy here? Do you feel safe? You know, are you loved? Are you cared for? That's, I'd say that's more human than corporate. And then we just try and apply that, really.
I want to come and work with you.
You'd be welcome. Have you got a habit?
No.
Oh, we can get you one.
So in my experience, finding hard to reach people is really difficult, as by definition, they're really hard to reach. So how do you connect with your workforce? Where do you find them? Where do they come from?
We don't reach them. We attract. People want to work for us. And in the communities we employ from, the word spreads pretty quickly. Having said that, we've got about 28 referring partners from, you know, addiction charities, mental health charities, obviously prisons, probation, who would recommend people to us. But it does, what's definitely the last 18 months, the biggest group of recruits has come from word of mouth, usually from family and friends. I think it's just reputation. I think often charities and third sector kind of, oh, we need to reach the hard to reach. They're not stupid. Make it really attractive for them. Just back yourself in some ways. But yes, of course, we have, you know, referring partners who, and we work very closely with a lot of support workers, go, oh, you know, I've got Sarah here. She's had this, she's had that. And we'll accommodate that. It doesn't always need to be like a full-time employee or a training scheme. It's like, how can we use our business to make someone's day better? And for some people, that means training and skills and moving up the ladder. Other people, it's just like, you know what? I just want to come and be somewhere and contribute a bit and, you know, hang out. So it's a blend, really.
What's the average tenure of your workforce? Are they with you for years, or do they use Roar as a springboard to go into something else?
It's really interesting, actually. So when we started, we kind of had this kind of sort of slightly romantic notion that, not romantic, but, you know, we'll get people in, we'll train them, give them confidence, and they can move on. But we very quickly changed and realized the gaps in the market for what we do are huge. So we basically have, I'd say it's 90% plus of people who start with us stay with us. Because as we've grown, we've had more jobs, and I think that's yeah, really, I think for us, quite a charming testament. People want to stay with us. So no, our model isn't about, oh, you know, here's our course for you, here's our program for you, and we're going to deliver this, and the government's going to pay us that, and you'll get an MVQ, which you can't possibly use ever because somebody in HR will read your CV, see a gap on it, and reject you straight away. I mean, no wonder people go back to prison and drugs. You know, it's more than that, because I think that the fundamental thing is, Sarah, that for lots of people, the tribes they've had before haven't been that positive for them, or they haven't had a tribe before since a tribe they don't belong to. The main thing for us all as kind of mammals is we want to belong. You know, we want to belong somewhere, and that's where we want to be. We're a tribe, and, you know, we get loads of stuff wrong. We squabble and bicker, and, you know, but, you know, really, if somebody came at our tribe, it would unite. You know, and that sounds, I don't mean to sound very kind of aggressive or anything, but there's something very fundamental that I think we've lost touch with as humans, that sense of being and belonging. And that's exacerbated if you've had a tough childhood, no strong family, if you've been isolated because you've been on the streets, because, you know, you've been told you're wrong because you got excluded from school. You become isolated, you become very insular, and then to be part of something where you're all, you know, you're not in a supportive work environment, you're at Roar because we're going to show these bastards how good we are. That's a very different place to come from, you know, and it's a uniting factor, I think.
I bet people never want to leave.
Oh, you know, hopefully not, you know. And the other thing is, you know, we've expanded a lot, and we do have, especially on the youth side, we have a lot of people who work with young people, more sort of support worker types people. And it always made me completely kind of baffled and slightly furious that the kind of third sector, charity sector, social sector, if you decide to dedicate your life to helping others, you should expect to get paid less
What are you talking about? What are you talking about? How absolutely bonkers.
So, yes, we're a successful business. We trade really well. But that doesn't just reflect in the people who work in the business side. Our support teams, I want them to be the best paid in the world. You know, because, and not to anybody else's scale of what you should get, what you shouldn't get. We as a unit, as a business, as an entity, create all this value, and that's going to get shared.
I absolutely agree. It'd be brilliant to be able to do it. Unless you're a social entrepreneur and you can make your own rules, the only way you can really go into charity and helping people is because you can afford to do that.
Yeah.
Crazy. Or you're prepared to accommodate that lifestyle, which is not right at all.
It's not right at all. So let's just shake it up. We didn't have a youth section when we, 2 years ago, we didn't have a youth section. Hazel and I, my head of operations, so my two senior people who work with me most closely are both females under 30. And that's been a massive influence on me and how I see the world, because, you know, I'm really old and, you know, kind of, even though I sort of, in a way, try and left the system, I'm sort of influenced by the system, I guess. And we walk around the workshop with Hazel, and she said, you know what, Ray? Well, if we got to most of these people 10, 15 years earlier, they wouldn't be with us. I went, you're right. And that's how we got into the youth thing. And now we have we're launching a school upstairs this September. The other thing that strikes me is if we, as a quite small business, can go, right, we're going to set up something great for kids. Why can't Shell do it? Why can't Mighty do it? Why can't other organisations do it?
Well, that actually takes me on to asking about the workshop you're doing with the kids. How did that all come about?
We all felt that the whole kind of system was a bit flawed about how young people who were excluded were treated, sort of thing, and all that kind of stuff. So I think the main thing that made it happen was people often talk about partnership, right? We're working partnership. We don't. We talk about working in relationships with people. So a big chapeau, huge hats off to Thames Valley Police, particularly James Humphreys in Thames Valley Police, who actually we decided to work together to make something better for young people who are involved in criminal justice, which resulted in Navigator Program, which basically means that a young person, what we call a reachable, teachable moment, which could be something like being arrested, has one of our workers with them very, very quickly. For only to go, hey, this isn't going really well, is it? I'm on your side, what do you want to do? And to take from there, and then we've now do education at our place, we do workshop training, we do work experience. And again, there's something very powerful about this sense of young people having a tribe that's not a school, it's not a gang. And I think without preempting your next questions, I guess, there was something very, people go, oh, you know, kids are joining gangs, it's very bad. It's very bad, kids joining gangs. And I was going, it's a cracking idea if you're a kid but nothing. Absolutely fantastic idea. What a great option. No, you can't say that. Well, it is. So we set about starting, basically creating a better gang. And so that's what we did. Yeah,
it's like you said, people want to find their people. And if you find your people in a gang, then at least you feel like you're belonging to something. So it's giving them a better option for something to belong to.
Oh, for sure. You know, like, especially as a younger person who's got nothing, being excluded from school, poverty, maybe not a great family, all that stuff, but mental health, it could be anything. And someone says, come over here. Look, I've got, you know, we'll look after you. Be one of us. And it's that be one of us, which is so powerful. You know, it's not like be a drug dealer, be a mule, be a victim of crime. It's be one of us. The consequences of being one of us aren't considered because you're young. You're looking for something. So us, I'll be one of us because you guys look really cool, right? You know, so that's a bit to focus on, not the, well, you know, if you join a gang, you might get stabbed, really. So I'll just stay in my room with nothing, with my head going around in circles, getting bullied. Okay, yeah, that's a great idea. Of course you're going to join a gang. But not of course you will, but, you know, it's appealing.
Yeah. I know you've told me previously that you've had some good outcomes. Share some of them with us.
Without being too specific, I mean, I think the first thing I'll say is you're referring quite a lot to the work with Thames Valley Police, which is true. But quite often that young person will also be involved in being excluded from school or with drugs, with mental health. So they typically somebody in the youth who's offending will have other issues too. So we might not pick him up via police. It might be through the various school partners or mental health partners. So I just want to make that clear. It's kind of a, it's generically with people, young people. And equally you might pick up a kid who's a kid, a young person who has been excluded from school, and then we'll find out actually they are in trouble with the police. So it kind of works lots of different ways. Success stories, yeah, I'll tell you a really good one. And it's actually quite general, really. Kids come in with their heads down, and very soon afterwards, they tend to be walking with their heads up and smiling. That's the outcome. You seem kids happier. Specifically, we have children who have gone on to go back into school. So we had a child who hadn't been in school for over a year, is now back in school. Still comes to us to pop in and say hi, but is now back in school. We have a young person who's now back living with their family. We have more than one young person who's now working for us when they turned 18. So there are lots of, you know, different outcomes. And you know what? The people say, oh, it's amazing. You've got a young person who's been in care all their lives. Parents have been, you know, addicted. All that kind of unpleasantness have made them understandably quite upset, and their life gone wonky, and now they're, you know, in stable accommodation, all that kind of stuff, and they're happier. But actually, you know what, the qualifications and going to college, that's all great stuff. But actually, if you can make a young person feel that they are something on their, in their own right, that's what it is. And then they can go find other things. And we're not about generating the outcome for them. We're about saying to them, you know what, you are worthwhile. You are good. You know, you can do good stuff, and you will get it wrong, and you will get in trouble. We're still here. You know, and I think that's the main thing that I see as an outcome, is young people just walking their heads up and making better choices most of the time.
That's really inspiring. You're based in Oxfordshire, but this sounds like it would benefit the whole country. Do you have any plans to expand?
Do we have any plans? Yes. It's interesting conversation, isn't it? Because strategically, do you expand geographically or do you expand your types of service? I mean, there's plenty of need in Oxfordshire and Thames Valley. Potentially there's national opportunities. We've been asked by a couple of people around, would we go to their area? Would we? I'm not sure. I think probably we'll just grow where we are and do different things, I think. But I think obviously the next growth point for me is Bali. I think we need one in Bali. So I think
everyone needs an office in Bali. I love the philosophy that everyone can help change the world, even in a small way, or as you put it, simply doing what every business should. Not only have you built a business around environmental and social cues, but now you're repurposing the empty space in your building, as you've said about the workshop for the kids. You always seem to be on the lookout for ways to make more of a social impact. What drives you?
I think it's the system and people saying, you can't do that. I get a massive buzz out of what we do and winning business. And when I've been involved with successful businesses before, it's about pace, and that pace filters through. So I think the time is now. You know what? And I think it's just the right bloody thing to do. You know, it's as simple as that, right? And I'm happy. You know, that's what motivates me. I'm happy. We're successful. We're helping people have better lives. We're doing our bit for the planet. And I just think it should be normal. You know, hopefully, like in 5 years' time, you'll never speak to someone like me going, oh, you're an exceptional person, or you've done something different. We should all be doing this. It's obvious, right?
So on that, for anyone who's listening, who's in a business that are thinking, that sounds amazing, we should do something like that, what would you say to them, or what would your advice be to them?
Do it. Give me a call. I mean, if you've got an idea, we'll talk about it and see what we could do together, or give you some advice. I think that's the other thing that people like me hopefully can do is add a bit of impetus, or go speak to this person, speak to that person, and genuinely not sort of mentoring nonsense, just actually, yeah, that's a cracking idea. Is it commercial? It's got to be commercial. Everybody wants to do good. Everybody wants to do good, but how will you do it? Where's the niche? Where's the niche you're going to embed that? Get your little crampons in there and then build your impact out from there. And I think that's where, you know, I'm really happy to chat to people. And don't overthink it, you know, do it. Just do it. You know, can you sell an ice cream that's got a bit more impact in it than another one?
I always have the philosophy, build it and they will come. Don't overthink it. Just do it. and see what happens.
Yeah, and there's a bit where people go, oh, I want to do, I was talking to somebody else from a very large company this week over lunch, and they were looking at doing, they wanted to do something more and different and stuff, and what could we do? I got these ideas, and I went, why have ideas? Look at existing markets, look at existing players, look where they're not creating social impact. Can you do the same thing and create social impact? If there's a yes there, there it is. You're an established market, the competitors who can't compete with you, go for that.
So as we've mentioned previously, your work touches so many areas: the green agenda, mental health, addiction, homelessness, adversity, criminality, young offenders. Within all of that, is there a particular area you'd like to focus on more?
Actually, no, because people, this is how the charity sector kind of works. Oh, we specialize in homelessness, we specialize in offenders. How many people who've been homeless do you know who haven't had potentially a drug issue or been in trouble with it? This is not, a categorized silos of, deprivation. Most people have had shit lives, right? Most people don't think they're worth anything. Right, that's it. They've done something amazing to not be there anymore, either give up the drug or something. Look, it's much harder to give up heroin than it is to get an MBA. Much harder. We don't recognize that. Tenacity, resilience, dedication, same things again and again, overcoming tough days. Much harder to give up heroin, than, especially if you're in poverty, than getting an MBA. No offense to MBA people, but we don't recognize the strength it takes. Or living on the streets and surviving, or having had a family who's always been involved in crime, you've been involved in crime, and you've come out of prison and you've got nothing, no qualifications, and actually the easiest thing in the world is to go back to that life, and you don't. That's remarkable. That's the employee I want. That's what we should stop looking at people by the definition of their past categorizations and just go, okay, wow, fucking hell, you're alive. Right, that's pretty cool. Sorry to swear, but I think it goes back to my point about, there are people at the moment, probably, what time is it now, about to have lunch in London on a table that probably cost, 1500 quid, and it's made by somebody who was in prison or somebody being on the streets, and they're having a £70 lunch on it. And there's something very powerful, I think, about that almost invisible success. There's something very powerful about it. And it's not about woodwork skills, it's about how good you want to be. Most corporates do buy from us because we do create social impact, we give them the stats, we can do the CO2 emission stuff, all that thing we can do, but it's not why we trade. We trade because we want to show you how good people are.
I love that, the invisible success. What are your biggest challenges running Raw?
It's mainly me going, should we start an airline? I think challenges are, just like any business, it's managing growth. It's keeping your culture true, which actually the more you leave it alone, I find, the more it kind of grows. And it's where to go next. I think it's making the right choices. Yeah, it's about focus, really. And the challenge, I suppose, from a social point of view is how can we best create more jobs? Where's more futures for people? But we will give them the futures with successful businesses. So we need to be careful. Yes, of course, it's about making sure it's sustainable and the finance is there, but that's not the end game. The end game is to grow. Because if we grow, we create those life-changing employment opportunities. And we meet some fantastic people. The other thing about working for Raw is, man, I meet some amazing people with some amazing stories. It's a really rich, interesting place to be. Some really eyebrow-raising kind of stuff and some really funny stuff. It's just a piece of life that is really rich. Yeah, some of it's quite dark, but ultimately there's a lot of richness in there.
And finally, so what's next for Rick and Raw? I know you mentioned the airline. What does growth look like? You have so many ideas in your head. Mm. What's next for you?
Well, I think that there are a couple of ideas, products we're looking at. One kind of area is, we use probably most of our products now are certainly the tops of tables of wood, but we're looking at other products, so reclaimed ocean plastic, coffee grounds. So what other products could we actually bring into our production line? So it's not necessarily changing what we do, but actually the variety of sustainable products. I think probably the next thing is questions around scale. So do we scale by saying grounds maintenance, buy more vehicles, getting more staff, or do you partner with a bigger organization and bring staff in through us to them type stuff? So it's, yeah, and the airline, obviously.
Well, thank you so much for your time, Rick. It's been great chatting with you. I'm sure all our listeners have learned an awful lot from your story. And for everybody out there, please tune into our next podcast.